Part 3. Tarakuma. Chapter 11. Idris. Monitor Joy, the Parthenis' stern diplomat, looked as though she might be Solis's aunt, though she had likely been born at least a decade afterwards. And the close-mouthed Partheni technician who came to perform some last-minute modifications to the Dark Joan might have been the executor's younger sister. Her expression showed a marked difference, though. She didn't approve of a pack of ruffians commandeering their ship. Still, she was plainly in awe of Solis and worked for 2 hours to get everything flight-ready. The Partheni packet transport was indeed short on space. There were 6 suspension beds in a central stack within the ring of the gravitic drive, and the pilot's seat was hard back against them. There was nowhere to be except the actual beds. Hold space was almost entirely filled by some new gear of Solis's and Ollie's Scorpion frame. The packet transport was intended to lug data after all, not goods. Idris wondered if Mordant House knew the things could be fitted out as emergency squad transport at a pinch. "Reminds you of wartime?" Solis asked, at his elbow. "Berlinhof."
"I think we had more space in wartime."
"You did. You were never in the racks. Picture something like this." She tapped the cluster of pods. "But for 100 people at a time. Civilians had luxury accommodation."
"I never knew. Although, I'd have been too busy being scared out of my mind to appreciate it."
He tried to look at her properly, and still couldn't. Not quite.
"Thank you, by the way," he mumbled.
"Hmm?"
"For helping. For the ship. Getting us to... The others probably won't say it."
"I've heard all the things they say about my people across the colonies, Idris. Probably they think I'm a monster who'll come and kill their menfolk and make regular humanity a footnote in our triumphal histories, right? Or else we're sex-starved sirens who just need to meet a good man to forswear all our Amazon ways."
"You've seen some media types," he observed.
"Executor training means exposure to some weird stuff. I'd rather have stayed a simple myrmidon." Idris cocked an eye at her, squinting sidelong. Something about her was still too much like staring into the sun, and he was worried that it was because he liked her.
"Why'd you go for it, then?"
And in the blank pause that question evinced, he realised.
"You didn't, did you? They just told you. Why? Not just for me."
She shrugged. "Probably not just for you. The Aspirat does some pretty twisty thinking sometimes. I think it was because I'd been through the war, so I'd met people from outside the Parthenon." She was closed up, abruptly, hugging her own arms. "Seems kind of mad that being a soldier made me right for something completely different." "Myrmidon Executor," the technician came out of the Dark Joan. "Prêt à combattre." She cast what Idris could only characterise as a scandalised look towards Rollo and the crew. Solis nodded, which turned out to be a dismissal, because the younger woman left the bay immediately, ceding the field. "It's time," Myrmidon Executor Solis turned to the crew. "Everyone on board and in the..." She stopped herself, and visibly reconsidered her approach. "Captain Rostand, your ship is ready." Rollo's truculent expression softened by a hair.
"Thank you, my good benefactor."
He put his nose through the hatch, clucked at the cramped conditions.
"Get yourselves to bed, my children. Not much else for it."
They filed aboard, and Chris stopped to put a strengthening hand on Idris's arm. He found a smile for her from somewhere and watched her pull herself up into the Jones confines. "You and her?" Solis asked him. Idris felt his expression turn wary again, but there didn't seem any hidden rocks to the question. Seeing his look, she waved away an answer. "Just thinking you'd be lucky. Definitely outranks you, that one." Her grin was natural, far too young for her, the way she'd smile with her Partheni comrades, perhaps. Then she'd taken his elbow and boosted him up. He took the aid automatically, without flinching, but once in the pilot's seat a moment later, he wondered, what just happened? Solis was already behind him, getting into one of the top pods. Then she paused and leaned over. You remember how it all... Sudden chagrin showed on her face. Do you need me to take you through?
I recognise most of this from the Pythoness.
The Partheni console had a dozen small screens, each devoted to separate metrics, and he looked them over one by one. Two were military enough that he felt he didn't need to worry about them. You didn't fly the Pythoness.
Who do you think got her back to Heaven's Sword at Berlinhof?
He felt his hands shake a little with the thought. Solis must have seen it. You're good, Idris? He was silent, staring at the controls. They were a clear evolution from those he remembered from the war, but he could do this. Eventually, he said in a small voice, I'll be fine. The Dark Joan slipped from Lungcrow orbital, like the dreams of a fish, as the saying went. It was swift and subtle, its departure cloaked by whatever standing arrangement the Parthenon had with the Kybernet. Idris checked the sleep pod's vitals and threw the graphitic drive into a low activity cycle, extending its shadow into unspace to plot out the conditions. From there, he could calculate their departure from real space. He glanced back at the neat rack of suspension pods behind him. 4 occupied, 2 empty, plus the incompatible aesthetics of Kit's garish red globe sticking out like a sore thumb. Then, he had committed them, and the Dark Joan fell into the liminal void beyond the real. It hadn't been like this on the Pythoness. He'd been surrounded by motion, running women performing desperate triage on the vessel's abused systems. There'd been blaring alarms and rapid orders and confirmations in Parsef, all as the vessel unleashed its weapons against the unthinkably vast face of the architect. The pilot's chair had been sunk partway into the floor there too, because even a Parthenon warship held space at a premium. The body of the original Partheni pilot, and a good dozen other casualties, had been hauled away with grim efficiency. Idris had dropped into the vacant seat, as though this was some bizarre dream. His elbows had been tucked in, his shoulders hunched forwards to avoid the women's booted feet. He'd been glad that he was smaller than the average colonial starveling. All around him, the injured vessel lurched and bucked, its brocator drive clutching at the gravitic substructure of real space for purchase. And beyond their hull, the colossal, invisible hand of the architect was reaching, deforming space as it tried to remake its enemy. The Dark Joan was not the Pythoness, of course. But her controls and the cramped pilot's seat recalled the old wartime vessel to him, the appalling chaos of their flight from the architect after the ship was crippled and half her crew killed. And then he was in unspace, strapped down tight and utterly alone with all those bad memories. The remembered architect to one side and to the other, patiently biding its time. The presence had been waiting for him. It was going to be a long trip through the deep void. Chris. You look rough. Chris was understating the case, but dealing with Idris in this kind of state was always hard. Honestly, he looked like he'd been disinterred. Standing in the close-walled orbital dock outside the Dark Joan, with his hands in his pockets and his shoulders bowed. His skin looked pallid and clammy as he used his slate as a mirror, propped against the curve of the Partheni ship's hull. He was lasering away a shadow of stubble, which would be back within a few hours.
"Where have you brought us, my boy?"
Rollo stretched and rolled his shoulders. Ollie was having the scorpion lift her into its cradle.
"Some kind of Partheni channel opened up when we quit Unspace," Idris mumbled. "Set a beacon for us to dock here. I mean, Tarakuma's not the safest place to just hang about in orbit."
"This is our safe house." Solis had unpacked new armour and was adjusting the fit of individual sections using an interface on her slate. The gear was devoid of company badges this time. She had a new accelerator weapon too. Tarakuma had no interest whatsoever in restricting the arms its visitors carried. "There's no embassy here, but there are groups we just about trust to do business with us."
"Even the Great Parthenon gets its fingers dirty, eh?" Ollie remarked.
Chris shot her a look. Back when Solis had first showed, everyone had been prickly with her, but Ollie seemed determined to carry on the feud, even though they were relying on Solis bending the rules for their benefit. Chris wasn't sure why, but something about Solis had got under the woman's skin. The Partheni just shrugged. "From here, it's your play."
"On our own now, is it?"
Rollo chewed at his moustache.
"Well, you've done right by us, my friend. We owe you."
"No," Solis broke in. "You don't understand. I will continue to back you. I just don't know what should come next. I don't know how this place works."
"Leave that to me," Chris broke in. "Me and Kit, anyway. Ready to spend some credits?"
The Hanalambra threw up some obscene human images from his library, showing exactly what he thought of that. But he displayed their largesse account anyway. "All spending kept to a minimum," came the translation, after some fiddling of his arms. "Do not negatively impact my retirement fund." Which sounded funny, but really was a matter of life and death to the Hani. They were docked at one of the elevator orbitals that ringed Tarakuma's equator. The planet's actual surface was harsh, scoured by radiation, high winds, and without enough atmospheric pressure for unprotected humans. Ancient geological tumult had left Tarakuma riven with chasms, some up to 5 kilometres deep. The air was thicker there, and conditions were more conducive to both native and visiting life. A dozen cities across the planet were built into the walls of these rifts, extending deep into the rock for vast vertical distances. Each habitation was home to millions of humans and other species, living like termites in constant close proximity. They were linked over the surface to the various elevator cables where the ground-based factions jealously controlled access to orbit. All real business had to be done planetside, no matter how inconvenient that was for anyone up above. It was just about the only thing every gang leader and petty overlord agreed upon. Orbitals that tried to cheat them were disciplined with extreme prejudice. What Chris could do from here in orbit was research her quarry. She could also make some initial overtures, and for that, she'd need to spend a little of Kit's retirement fund. Nobody here was going to help her out of the goodness of their hearts. Not even Prosecutor Threnikos, who was practically an old friend. She'd crashed out of Scintilla's Inns of Court, barely snagging her credentials as she ran out of the door. But Livo Threnikos hadn't even managed to qualify after they'd caught him stuffing bribes into his pockets with both hands. However, Tarakuma didn't care about official credentials, only malign ability. The place was a weird sort of meritocracy like that. So it was that her old friend had somehow ended up here, with a hastily conferred practicing certificate from a Tarakuman law school that probably hadn't existed 5 minutes beforehand. then Threnikos, had been put to work to magically transform the underhand into the legitimate. He took her comms call readily enough. She was expecting. She didn't know what, to be honest. It had been years. Would he have grown bloated and corrupt with overfine living? Or maybe have an eye patch and a cybernetic hand? As it happened, Prosecutor Livo Threnikos looked far better than she expected. His long-chinned dark face had grown prosperously fleshy without losing its strength, and he was sporting a moustache of remarkable curling richness. His eyes lit up when he saw her, which was reassuring. Maybe he wouldn't fleece them too much for his services.
"Nals Visnir Orbital, no less," he exclaimed, seeing where she was transmitting from. "What brings you to my humble hemisphere, Kerry?"
Because back on Scintilla they'd put the stress on the first syllable of Kerestina, so the name had worn down differently on repeated use. "Information? Introductions?"
"Setting up business here."
He raised an eyebrow and flashed brilliantly white teeth. "Would it threaten you if I did?" Despite herself, she smiled back at him. He'd always been utterly amoral, and she guessed that hadn't changed. He'd definitely been more fun than her fellow students, in a variety of interesting ways. Wouldn't bring the price down, but she found herself wondering if he'd make a nice diversion once the current problems were sorted out.
"Come work with me," he said, apparently sincere and without hesitation.
Chris found herself genuinely touched.
"Tempting," she replied. "But my ship's captain has a Terracuman issue, and we're here to sort it out." "That covers a lot of ground. Is this the sort of issue that leaves bodies?" "God, I hope not," she said, honestly enough. "No more than we've had already. We need contacts, and we need an introduction. Beyond that, we'll sort ourselves out. No dirt on your doorstep, Liv. Can you help?" "Let me look at you."
And he did for a while. And she wondered about him. Was he married? With children? How much of a life could you carve out on a planet splintered into gang territories and ruled by criminal fiefdoms? Probably quite a good one, if you were careful. At last he smiled, a little sadly.
"Who are you in the shit with, Kerry?"
"Hopefully nobody, but we need to talk to Broken Harvest." His face went into professionally blank mode as he thought about that. Likely Threnikos had no direct links with the Harvest, given how many factions had a stake on Terracuma. But he'd know someone. Or someone who knew someone. Or he'd sell Chris and her crew out to them. She was banking a lot on their old association.
"That should be possible."
His professional face was still on, but he was nodding. "They're hegemonic, which makes it hard to get to them directly. But I can scare up a minister to make the necessary introductions. That do you?"
"That would be perfect. There's the small matter of our factor will liaise on the fee, both yours and this minister's.
You're fine with coming down the line for the meeting. They like their face-to-face contact here."
"I know," she confirmed. "It'll be good to see you again, Liv."
After that, the crew had a near ludicrous argument about who was going to the surface. Chris said it would be just her and Kit, but Rollo said if he didn't get to save his own ship, no one was going. Then Rollo wanted Solace along, in case it was a trap. Ollie said that she wasn't going to just wait around with Idris. Even Idris was riled by then, and said he'd just been alone in Unspace and wouldn't repeat the experience in orbit. Chris brought the whole business full circle, saying that if they appeared on Threnikos's doorstep mob-handed, he'd probably call the authorities, and given this was Tarakuma, those would basically be trigger-happy criminals. So Chris decreed that she, Rollo and Kit would go, and everyone else could loiter in the neighbourhood. Thranakos's offices were a quarter of the way across the planet in Coaster City, so they all piled back into the ship. Kittering took over the comms and fielded what must have been 20 different demands for ID and tolls, from whichever groups controlled individual slices of sky. Some were paid and some weren't, based on what Kit could glean about their relative status. Thranakos had recommended a planet-side dock, where they could be relatively sure the ship would still be there on their return. On arrival, Solis activated all the security the Dark Joan had, though Chris reckoned that Tarakuma's best ship thieves could outplay the order-loving Parthenon's locking systems. Kit grudgingly pledged some largesse to the dock owner for added surveillance, and Ollie left a camera remote on watch. Other than that, they'd just have to hope that Thranakos was as good as his word. On Tarakuma, the poorest districts were closest to the inhospitable surface. High-speed elevators conducted the better class of criminal into the chasm, where radiation was less of a threat and the air actually filled the lungs. So it was, in that first trip, they didn't see much of Coaster City's worst side. In fact, the law and order of the docks and the glitzy retail outlets they passed were as civilised as anything Chris had seen. With Thranakos vouching for them, they got to use the scenic elevator. The clear-walled car rushed them down an inertially dampened rail on the outside of Coaster City, with a view of the local flora and fauna. Tarakuma's macrobiology flourished within the chasms, simultaneously reaching for and shrinking from the solar radiation above. What they saw looked like something from a children's story, where a gem merchant had planted his stock and found it growing in the morning. Vines crawled up the chasm's sides in a riotous profusion, budding and fruiting with faceted nodules. Leaf-like plates spread to sieve the distant sunlight, which fell in increasingly impoverished rainbows to the tiers below. Chris saw mobile life there too, jewelled beetle forms and lurching baubles with a spidery leg span of 10 metres or more. Nothing looked familiar, or even organic. Here and there were cages, half hidden in creeping foliage, that writhed visibly. Many of the governing gangs and cartels like to make a public show of their displeasure. Most of the human body couldn't be metabolised by the native life, but salt and water were potent lures. It wasn't the animals that got you, she understood, but the diamond-sharp tips of the questing vines. What lovely places we end up visiting. Within Livo Threnikos's reception rooms, there was a good span of armoured glass, looking onto exactly the same vista. But he was low enough down the chasm that noon outside looked like twilight, and the whole serpentine jungle glowed and glinted with a constellation of gleaming bioluminescence. It really was very pretty, if you could forget its lethal potential. The remaining crew had found a fairly genteel eatery where they could wait. They departed, grumbling that they couldn't afford to eat there, but Chris's waspish thought was that it had been their choice to come in the first place. The life of a Tarakuman prosecutor agreed with Livo, Chris had to admit. He was wearing a suit cut in the Berlinhof style, with plenty of pleating and wide sleeves. Tarakumans valued show, though, so instead of drab yet expensive greys, Thranakos wore russet, with lines of gems set into lapels and cuffs. Chris would have preferred to dress up as well, but her wardrobe had gone with the rest of the Vulture God. Livo met her with a fond smile and a wrist clasp that became a brief slapping match as each went to tug the collar of the other. An old student habit from Scintilla, where your honours grade was worn as a coloured flash at the throat. Despite his years of easy living, he actually beat her to it, but paused, hand on her scarf. He was one of the few people who knew why she wore it. She stretched up on her toes and lightly kissed his cheek. Then he ushered the three of them into his office, making sure everyone got a good gawk at another glimmering view. A table had been set with finger food for three humans and two Hanny. The minister they'd come to meet was already seated, one of Kit's conspecifics rolling a few nuts around the tabletop with his smaller mandibles. Chris had to stop herself staring, because this was a rich Hanalambra, and she hadn't seen many of those on the spacer circuit. His shell was encrusted with organic gems in complex spiralling patterns. A half dozen bejewelled critters, the size and shape of human thumbs, were tethered to his shield arms with gold chains. They were in constant motion across these armoured surfaces, scattering the light with their faceted backs. "Advocate Almier," Livo introduced Chris. "And Captain Rostand, Factor Kittering, this is Minister Shreem." And with that, he had earned his payment, save for a little light hosting and pouring the wine. Chris considered that although he'd been kicked out of the Scintilla law schools while she'd left with her dignity intact, Threnikos had certainly landed on his feet. Minister Shreem's legs chirped and rattled against each other, and a translator bobbing on the swag of his soft belly said,
"I am, of course, delighted to make your acquaintance. I wish you all prosperous endeavours."
The voice was an old man's, rich and husky, with a slow, assured cadence. Chris wondered how much he'd paid for it.
"Now, I understand that you're desirous of an introduction."
"To Broken Harvest," Rollo broke in. "A matter of some urgency, my friend."
Shreem settled lower on his stool by a delicate rearrangement of his six legs. His quintet of eyes gazed calmly at Rollo, the spikes above them capped by a jewelled diadem. Minister Shreem, it seemed, did not wish to be hurried. Then Kit chirped something, and the minister shifted again, leaning forwards. There was a staccato exchange, mostly shorn of any context Chris could follow. Kittering seemed to be bragging about something, or at least he was raising his shield arms. This generally meant a Hanny was establishing his credentials in some way. Then the two of them just left the table and went to play landstep on a virtual board projected by the minister from one of his gem clusters. Rollo and Livo seemed equally wrong-footed by this, but the Hanny were a competitive species amongst their own kind. Chris had seen business deals concluded over wrestling matches, impenetrable puzzles, and even dance-offs. The Hanny didn't wage war, funnelling all their disagreements into a myriad of contests. That left the three humans to make small talk for an hour, as the Hanny became more and more absorbed in their tournament. Chris kept casting a worried eye over, in case Kit was wagering anything they couldn't do without. But his screens were cagily blank as he placed his tiles with rapid assurance. Livo dropped more than one hint that Chris could leave the spacer life for a while. Perhaps come and do business with him, or partner up in other ways. He was in a stable relationship, with two other men and a woman, with three children between them, but there was always room for more. It was the sort of communal arrangement that had become common after Earth, when families had been shattered and people clung to and nurtured whoever they could find. To her surprise, Chris found the idea of settling down not quite the anathema she'd have thought. But she wasn't ready to quit spacefaring just yet. "You've got a good thing going on here, Liv," she said, surprised at the envy in her voice. "There's always a better thing." And he rested two fingers on her hand, just lightly. Rollo coughed loudly, and Chris shot him a testy look. Thankfully, at that point, the game broke up. Kit's screens showed a cascade of bright colours and images that looked triumphant. Chris glanced worriedly at Shreem, in case Kittering had caused offence. The minister seemed entirely satisfied by the clash.
"A price has been agreed,"
Shreem's old man voice announced, and Chris assumed Kit's landstep prowess had earned a discount.
"Captain Rostad, given your urgency, is it convenient for contact to be made with the Harvest's factor immediately?"
Rollo nodded vigorously.
"You must understand that there are many layers of hierarchy within the Harvest, as with the Essiel,"
Shreem went on pedantically.
"Navigation through lower ranks will be required before meeting some mid-grade overseer, who might or might not have sufficient authority to make a contract. You may find the process aggravatingly drawn out."
All said with grinding slowness and no apparent irony.
"All the more reason to get started," Rollo replied through clenched teeth.
Chris checked in with the others while she waited, and Rollo started to pace. Then Minister Shreem made a surprised sound, like a string section thrown into disarray, and scuttled in a backward circle. It was a display of discombobulation she'd never seen in a Hanny before.
"Hold on," she told Idris over the comms. "Something's happened."
"Well?"
Rollo demanded of the minister.
"What then? Some flunky will see us at his own damn leisure."
"The matter has developed in an entirely different direction."
Shreem's artificial voice sounded calm, but his limbs were flurrying with agitation.
"Invitation is made to the court of Aklu himself. Aklu being the title of the Harvest's undisputed ruler. You are going straight to the top."